Okay, any questions to last lecture? No. So today, so we finished with writing the action, and well, on Monday or on Tuesday, we said this action describes the topological theory, and the reason for that is that the gauge symmetries actually eat up the degrees of freedom given by the metric field, or in our case by the triad and the connection. And so we will now discuss these gauge symmetries a bit from a covariant or from an action perspective, and because later we will discuss the canonical perspective, and you might have seen a bit the covariant perspective and Noether's theorem, but mostly in the context of global symmetries. So here we have gauge symmetries, and usually what that means, so gauge symmetries leave your action, so that's a transformation of the fields which leave your action invariant in a non-trivial way, where non-trivial means that it has a non-trivial action on the solution of your system. So otherwise, you can find many things which leave your action invariant, because an action is just one function. But the point is that it should also act non-trivially on the solutions. Otherwise, it's a trivial gauge transformation. And so in this case, for gauge trafos, these are referred to as local symmetries. So the reason being, for instance, if you fix the boundary values on some boundary, then usually what we are used to is that the boundary values uniquely determine the field, the solution for the field inside. If you have a gauge symmetry, that means you can actually change something, the field content, locally here, without affecting the boundary values. So that means, since you know it's a transformation which does not affect the boundary values, we said it leaves the action invariant. So if you have a solution which is an extremum of the action, and if you make a transformation, then it's still an extremum in the action, in the meaning that the action is actually not an extremum, but it's a kind of saddle or a ridge. so we have here a non-uniqueness of solutions. Even for fixed boundary values. And so what one does in physics is actually then to declare solutions to be gauge equivalent if they only differ by these gauge transformations. If you have a global, so it's called local symmetry because you can vary the parameters of the gauge symmetry so that they are kind of vanishing outside, say, a compact region, and so they don't affect the boundary values. Global symmetries, that usually means that your parameters of your transformations are global, they are not space-time dependent, so they act everywhere, and so they do change also the boundary values. And so a global symmetry, they transform solutions with some boundary values into another solution with some other boundary values. So global symmetries, you still know, they do transform solutions into solutions, but they also do affect the boundary values. And local symmetries well, if you choose them to be vanished, the parameters to vanish outside the compact region, they do not affect the boundary values. Now, what you can do, of course, is to take something which is a gauge transformation and let it act also on the boundaries. And that is a much more complicated story, which we will not go much into. But then you have a situation where a gauge symmetries could turn into basically global symmetries. And that's an important point, because global symmetries, they lead to conserved charges. And that you might know as Noether's first theorem. So rotation, we have symmetry on the rotation that leads to preservation of angular momentum. Translations in time is energy, and so on. We will see that gauge transformations, in principle, they lead also to charges. But these charges are actually constrained to vanish. And you have many, many gauge transformations. So in principle, you get many, many charges, but they are all constrained to vanish. And as a canonical formalism, this will lead to constraints. But then if you choose gauge transformations also to act in a global way so that they do affect boundary values, then you might actually get non-vanishing charges. So one has to be a bit careful with these different notations. Okay. So we will go a bit through Noether's theorem and actually derive something which is known as Noether's second theorem, from which you can rederive the first theorem. So it's actually much more powerful than the first theorem, but funnily it's much less known. So we will assume, we will assume that we have an action given as a integration over local Lagrangian, so for, just with first order derivatives, with fields phi a. And we will assume that there is a symmetry transformation delta S phi alpha, which acts on the fields. So that the action is almost invariant under the symmetry transformation, meaning that you still allow for a change by a boundary term. How do I write it? So that would be so meaning that if we vary the Lagrangian, this Lagrangian can still change by as one epsilon. Written the wrong way, I think. by a divergence. And so lambda mu parameterizes me the way this parameterizes me a possible boundary term which can emerge. And I make one assumption in the following. I assume that the symmetry only acts on the field and not on the coordinate. I mean, it does not act on the coordinates. So if it also acts on the coordinates, like a diffeomorphism, you need to put some extra terms, which I'm not going to do. Okay. So, well, this is, we just vary this Lagrangian, and this you have hopefully done 1,000 times, because it's the same calculation you would do to vary an action and to get the Euler-Lagrange equations. So, if the variation Lagrangian with respect to the fields themselves, the variation with respect to the first derivatives. And then so that's just this variation written out. As usual, we make an integration by parts on this term. Well, let me write this. And you get the Euler-Lagrange equations. Plus, here, if you do an integration by parts, you get a boundary term. Which is the total divergence. So this we will call L alpha, because these are the equations of motion. L alpha equal to V0 gives you the equation of motion. And now we are almost done. So we said that the variation should give us a total divergence in terms of these lambdas, and we see that this variation is given by this expression. So if you bring everything on the same side, we get something which again is a total divergence. It's this term. Minus this term, and then we have the equation of motion term. Actually, we explicitly have the equation of motion term here, and we find that if you write it out in concrete cases, this combination of fields has to vanish. And actually, this gives you identities, and these are known as generalized Bianchi identities. And so these are really mathematical identities in the sense that they hold off-shell. And if you would do it, diffeomorphisms, you would actually find that these equations tell you really the Bianchi identity for in terms of Riemann geometry. contracted Bianchi identities. So that's why it's called generalized Bianchi identities. Okay.
Why do they hold off shell?
Hmm?
Why do they hold off shell?
We have not put, we have not assumed that the equation of motion hold, because this is alpha. Could put non-vanishing here.
But so we have zero equals the sum of those two terms. I would imagine that the logic is if the equations of motion hold, so we don't get the second term, then the first term vanishes.
Then the first term has to vanish. Uh-huh. And I'm saying if you still write the equation of motion, you get something which is like a mathematical identity.
Okay.
So for instance, if you would do it for the diffeomorphisms, you would find some contraction of the Bianchi identities. But of course, now we can actually, so as the next step, we will assume that the equation of motion hold. And we will consider global symmetries and then local symmetries. And this will give us immediately the first Noether theorem as preservation of charges. So that will be the next step.
We still assume that our action was changing just by a boundary term, right?
Yeah.
Isn't this, I mean, this is not true all the time, so.
No, the assumption is that we do have a symmetry.
So
of course, if you write so that this transform, this variation is a special one.
Sorry.
Yeah. So such that the action is only changed as a by a boundary term. Of course, cannot be an arbitrary variation. But for instance, for our triads and connections, if you rotate, you know, so the rotation, even locally, if you rotate at each point, that will give you such a transformation, which does preserve the action. And this boundary term, if you have a gauge symmetry, you can set the epsilon to be zero outside the compact region. So then you actually don't have this boundary. I mean, you can put it to zero. So the boundary term is in particular important if you consider global symmetries, where this is not possible. So let's assume we have a global symmetry. Yeah, so actually the last thing is that the generalized Bianchi identities are the mathematical identities which make sure that the action is invariant under the symmetry transformation you consider. So it's basically, we just have shown that meaning that if you have a symmetry transformation which does leave the action invariant modulo this boundary terms, this symmetry transformation needs to satisfy this equation. Okay, so let's assume that we have a global symmetry, and the global symmetry is acting only on the fields. It has this form. And so where epsilon is constant, it does not depend on space-time. And we assume that the equation of motion hold. So we go on shell. So then, of course, we know that this term has, well, then we can conclude indeed that this term is zero. And what is in the bracket? Well, that's defined as current. It's just the expression in the in the brackets, and it does say that the integral over the divergence of this current is zero. So if you go to a standard some time slicing, and you consider boundaries at some time t0 and t1, the fact that this divergence, the integral over this divergence vanishes, tells you that you have a global, a preserved charge, preserved under time evolution. Which is a normal component here, so of your current. Yeah. Okay. So to be safe, consider a situation where you really have something. Think where you have an orthonormal frame, or you are actually in F coordinates. Where lambda is equal to zero. Otherwise, I think you need to introduce a normal to the surfaces. So this is usually what you learn in a quantum field theory, and gives you the charges which are preserved under time evolution. Okay, now we look at the situation that we have a local symmetry. And we say, well, that epsilon is only non-vanishing in a compact region well inside these boundaries. So it vanishes near the boundary and at the boundary. Then let's say we make a further assumption on how this gauge trafo is assumed, is allowed to act. So we allow for a term, one term which is completely local in the parameter. but it can depend on space-time, so we might also have a derivative of epsilon. And that comes with a different thing. So in principle, you can have higher derivatives, but typically if you have this action with first order derivatives in the fields, that covers most of the interesting cases. Okay. So we also assume that L alpha, the equations of motion, hold. So we know that this term in the brackets is again zero, because epsilon, we assume that epsilon vanishes outside the compact region and at the boundaries. We can even put this term to be zero, still a total divergence. And so this transformation will vanish outside our compact region, and it will be it's quite arbitrary. So actually, we not only know that the integral is zero, but also that this integrand is zero. So here we use that we can vary epsilon. And so you can make it small enough so that even you can, it's not only that the integrals vanish, but also things, the stuff in the integral vanishes. And so here we can write that out in a power series, or actually in a derivative expansion for epsilon. So it's the first derivative as a zeroth derivative. You have the first derivative terms. And then there's one second order, a second derivative term in epsilon. Okay, now again, we do assume that this gauge trapho leaves the action invariant for basically arbitrary choices or sufficiently smooth choices of epsilon. This allowed us to conclude that the integrand vanishes. Now we have that this combination vanishes. We've written it as an expansion in the derivatives of epsilon. But since epsilon is kind of arbitrary, we can conclude that every term in front of these different derivatives has also to vanish. So this means that this term vanishes. This combination vanishes, and this term vanishes. So we can write that. So epsilon is arbitrary. That's our assumption about having a gauge symmetry. Then we can conclude that this term vanishes. And this system vanishes, and the last equation is that system vanishes. Satz. There should be some partial data, some partial data, which should be all variations. okay, here. This is a C alpha mu. And here, partial derivatives are symmetric under change of mu nu, so I write also the symmetrized part here. Yeah?
Yeah, I have a question on the definition of our symmetry transformation.
Uh-huh.
We say that it it's this, if we do a variation of phi, it gives me an extra term that is a divergence of something, and.
Oh, you mean this? Ah, you, there or there?
Just there, yeah.
Okay.
From the
yeah. Yeah.
And
So you're asking.
Super clear at the beginning that the epsilon here had something to do with the epsilon here. Is it something? I mean.
No, this is the same epsilon.
Yeah.
And in the gauge case, I assumed that the epsilon is basically just non-vanishing in a compact region away from the boundary. So I can also set to zero this divergence term.
But okay, it's just this, we want this current to be, we want this extra term to be of the order of epsilon. That's also a part of our assumption of the symmetry transformation, or because if I don't know. It wouldn't be continuous. Just from the very beginning, it wasn't super clear if epsilon, where did epsilon come from? Is it arbitrary? Is it?
So here in the gauge case, it's arbitrary, except that I require it to vanish it at the boundary and near the boundary. And I basically need to be sufficiently smooth in the sense that you know, here up to first order derivatives or second order here, because I make a second order derivative expansion, so at least the second order derivatives need to be sufficiently smooth. So then you can, so that means it doesn't need to be analytic, so it can still vanish in a compact outside the compact region. okay, so now if a gauge, so basically if a gauge symmetry exists of this form, what we have shown is that Z and the equation of motion hold. We have seen that these three identities need to hold. And now what we use, well, now typically what we have is a first order action. We've seen in the Einstein-Hilbert case is not necessarily the case, but then there's this divergence vanishing. But in our first order Palatini action, that's certainly the case. So,
isn't that wrong? Shouldn't it be mu nu? And I mean,
yeah,
it should be contracted, and also in the first.
So usually if your Lagrangian just depends on phi and first derivative of phi, and you consider something like initial value formulation, then your boundary values at a fixed time are phi and dot phi. So this fixes your, in the usual case, that fixes your time evolution. And also, if you just consider a scalar field, you can choose phi and phi dot freely on a given hypersurface. Yeah?
Like, are these like all partial derivatives or variations?
So these are all variations.
Maybe denominator?
All variations.
No, those should be partial
yeah,
derivatives.
Yeah, I think they are partial, all of them, because they are coming from the thing that we have.
Yeah, it a bit. Yeah, so sorry. Yeah, it depends on how you. Sorry. Yeah, depends on what your convention is. So it's a derivative with respect to the field. Yeah, it's a partial derivative with respect to the field of the Lagrangian.
Yes, so
sometimes
like the mu phi a with respect to mu phi a is not one, is one instead of delta.
Yeah, so it's
very partial.
The derivative with respect to the first derivatives of this. Sometimes, and yeah, I don't know if sometimes people write it with a variation or not. That's anyway.
Yeah, that's bad because then you end up writing direct deltas that you shouldn't be writing.
It's a functional derivative. But not a partial derivative. Or something like. So, yeah. Where was I? So. Usually we have that phi and phi dot, the first time derivative of phi can be freely chosen and define you the solution. So here, let's assume that c is not vanishing. Then this equation, it will involve phi and phi dot. And it will give you an equation which has to hold for phi and phi dot. So it gives you a constraint on phi and phi dot. In a sense that constraint, in a sense it tells you that your initial value data are not freely choosable. And these initial data have, this constraint has to hold so that you get a solution. So all solutions satisfy this have to satisfy this equation, which this was our assumption of going on shell. On the other hand, we see now that this means that not all phi and say d0 phi are freely choosable.
Why did we make the assumption that we were on shell?
Because if we are not on shell, we have to write all these other terms, and the point is that, in fact, these constraints will be part of the equation of motion.
Because I thought that if the variation vanishes. On the, if we're going to let the variation only be different than zero in a compact region, then the integral of the derivative of that thing, of that current, has to be equal to zero via Stokes' theorem, not via anything that we have done thus far, right? Is that correct? So the first time, the integral of that derivative, if we restrict to epsilons that are zero in a compact region, then has to be zero by Stokes' theorem.
You mean this term? Yeah. But we also know that epsilon is arbitrary. So it's not only zero because of Stokes' theorem, but it's also zero because epsilon is also the integrand is zero. Because we can vary this, we can put quite arbitrary epsilon. And epsilon also sits here. So that's where we started from. We started from the assumption that this divergence needs also to vanish. And if C is non-vanishing, then this gives you a non-vanishing condition, and it typically involves the phi and the first order derivative. And if C is vanishing, then you get a condition from here, which gives you the same kind of constraint. So what you do get is a is conditions on the initial value, on the initial values, so that you can actually consistently evolve the initial values to a full solution.
I think you forgot the term. When you write below local symmetry, zero equal this divergence, there should also still be the lambda term, which kind of shifts the pieces.
Yeah, I have set it to zero.
By hypothesis, though.
Yeah.
Ah, okay, sorry. In general, it is the root together with the B. Wherever you have a B, you should also. If that was part of the confusion of the questions.
So it's generally. It's part of, you know, we assume that epsilon vanishes
because it's a total type.
Near the boundary.
No, but you.
But you're considering the boundary with a total divergence.
So. Sorry, see, we assume that epsilon is vanishing.
Yeah, but.
Near the boundary, so you can write this term with a d mu epsilon as a boundary term.
No, I agree, but also this.
This is also.
Generalized Bianchi identity,
yeah.
You have this divergence.
Yeah.
And now we say that on shell, this vanishes.
Yeah.
And we now use arbitrary epsilon.
Yeah.
And delta S of phi, there is an epsilon B.
Yeah.
And let's forget about the derivative for now. And so if we collect epsilon on the side, we know that that divergence must vanish.
Yeah,
this difference must vanish locally, but it is dl.
So you treat
dot times b minus lambda.
So you treat these two terms a bit differently. I agree that that's what's happening here. So let's say that holds if lambda is really
lambda is zero.
Is zero from the outside. If you have a gauge symmetry where lambda is zero.
Okay, that for sure.
If not, you have to put the lambda there.
Yeah, okay. Just one.
Which maybe here is So you have to decide when to make lambda vanishing.
Now I think in the notes lambda is included in the current.
In the current, yeah, but then I say in the text somewhere. Anyway. in the gauge symmetry case. So, anyway, the constraints, we will rederive the constraints at some later point. So this will be, it's really a general feature of gauge symmetries that you get conditions on the initial data. And so we will see that in the canonical formulation, which we will do next week. In the last few minutes, we can actually really look at just the symmetries of our first order action. Pallottini action. Which has been this action. And there's two obvious gauge symmetries. There's two obvious symmetries because we introduced the tetras and said they give you the metric for different rotated triads, give you the same metric. So here, indeed, we have two indices, internal indices contracted with each other. And that's where the internal rotation would be acting. But since you contract these two indices, you get invariance under this action. and the other, well, more or less obvious symmetry, gauge symmetry, will be diffeomorphisms. Again, because here you have you integrate a density weight 1, where the density weight is in this epsilon. And so what if you do that, such an integral is invariant under diffeomorphisms. So what I wanted to do is to write explicitly these transformations on the fields and just state that, I mean, tell you, we will not prove it, but that the action is invariant under these symmetries, because later these symmetries will reappear in the canonical formalism. And we will exactly need these transformations. So rotation acts on the triads by rotating the internal index of the triad. And if you are infinitesimally if you take an infinitesimal rotation, I write this epsilon. The infinitesimal, the Lie algebra elements of SO3 are given by your epsilon tensor. Contracted with a parameter which tells you which rotation you're considering. So that allows the combination of Lie algebra elements, and epsilon ij for fixed k is the basis for this Lie algebra. So it gives you a matrix for different k's. so that means infinitesimally, if you consider a rotation with a lambda parameter of your triad, that would be how your triad changes on with the first derivative of your of your transform triad. You basically survive with the epsilon here. And you have your lambda parameter. Okay, so that's E, the other variable we have is omega. And so omega, you could go through the formula for omega in terms of the triads and co-triads and work that out, how omega changes. And let me give you the result. And it's something which is very similar to how the connection, also the Levi-Civita connection, changes. So you have a partial derivative of your gauge parameter, but you have also an affine term here. The other way around. You have the usual transformation law for the internal index, and you have an affine term here where the partial derivative of lambda appears. And so this happens to be the covariant derivative of our parameter lambda. And so typically, that's a typical transformation rule for a connection in a fiber bundle under gauge transformations. Okay. And so next time, we will also consider the diffeomorphisms and write the transformation rule there. And we will see that there's another symmetry, which is a bit unexpected, because it seems so we have too many symmetries, and this symmetry will change the E field, and it's known as shift symmetry. But then we will figure out that shift symmetries, together with rotations, can give you or on-shell the diffeomorphisms. So there will be combinations between these symmetries which actually vanish, and that will describe you all the symmetries. And the diffeomorphisms are somehow the non-obvious combinations of the rotations and the shift symmetries. And the rotation and shift symmetries are much simpler to treat and have a much simpler algebra. And so that's one reason why 3D gravity is easier, because you can actually replace the diffeomorphism symmetry with the shift symmetries and the rotation symmetries. And so that's why, well, later also the Hamiltonian constraints, in principle, they will actually just implement these shift symmetries. And you can, we know how to write the combination so that you can get the diffeomorphism symmetry. Okay, so we will do that next lecture.